This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee. Learn about the wonderfully tart Montmorency cherry at choosecherries.com.
Hi, welcome to Why Food Podcast, the podcast about career changers, innovators, and entrepreneurs. I'm your host, Valerie Lomas.
And I'm Ethan Frisch.
And today, our guest is Steven Satterfield. He is the founder and editor of Whetstone Magazine and also the podcast host of Point of Origin. Thanks so much for being with us, Steven.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, what I think is most incredible about your journey, which we're going to get into, is where you are now with Whetstone Magazine, which is just a beautiful, independently produced magazine. And I think you've done something that, especially as a person of color, we all think about when we think about getting a seat at the table. You created the platform that you wanted to see. Can you tell us a little bit about the inception of Whetstone and how it's been able to kind of stand the test of time? Because you're years into this magazine at this point.
Yes. Well, I think that, our origin story is similar to many entrepreneurs in that we, or in this case, I had a profound interest in career in food and drink. And I was and have always been really serious about, all facets of it. I was in culinary school as a teenager, worked professionally in the industry, worked in some great restaurants as a manager and sommelier for over a decade. So I had a pretty exhaustive education in the industry and really felt like the experiences that I had had weren't being adequately reflected in the kinds of print magazines in particular that were in circulation. And specifically what that was really about, kind of decolonizing the way that food was reported on in mainstream food media, and really using origin as a framework of understanding food, as opposed to, especially when we started a few years ago, a real obsession and fetishization around, the craft that happens only in the kitchen, which is just such a small part of the story of food.
I mean, I do want to touch on something that you just said about the decolonization of food and how you felt a need to kind of dig into that and explore that more. You mentioned your rather exhaustive education and on-the-job experience in the industry. Did you just get to a point where you were fed up with kind of what you were seeing produced as food media? Were you just kind of fed up with it?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. I kind of came into media twofold. The first time I entered in media making was by accident in 2008. I had started a nonprofit organization. I had already been working in hospitality for a few years. I had graduated from culinary school, had become a sommelier, and had kind of a crisis moment in 2007 when I was living and working in Portland, Oregon, and realized that my relationship to food was really not the relationship to food that I wanted to have. And by that, I mean, I was serving and interacting with a very small segment of the population, a very privileged segment of the population who were able to enjoy and indulge in very fanciful multi-course dinners with really expensive European wines with great cachet and so on. And what I began to realize is that narrative was actually really damaging for me as a professional, because it really undermined the thing that I loved most about food, which is how dynamic and universal it really is. And so when the conversations about food, which is sort of this, you know, unifying part of all of our collective human history, when that had just been reduced to, like, you know, all the same chefs who had gone to all the same culinary schools who are cooking the same types of food, and representing that as kind of the story of culinary art or the story of food, really did a disservice to, you know, so many cultures who have helped define, you know, the preeminent dining culture of France and of the United States and really around the world. So using this origin, I almost forgot the question. So basically in 2008, I had this moment when I said, like, I really want to change the relationship that I'm having. So I started a nonprofit organization. I moved to Atlanta, where I'm from. I came back home and I decided to work with Black and Indigenous growers in the Western Cape of South Africa, where all the South African wine comes from. It sounds like a pretty esoteric project, but again, at this time I was already a sommelier, so I already was deeply grounded in, you know, wine as really a language and as a vocation. And what I wanted to do was really focus on and really center the labor that goes into making the wine, which all over the world is quite different than the winemakers who are receiving the accolades for the wine. And in South Africa in particular, it felt like a personal situation for me because I was a Black sommelier. There were very few, 12 years ago. And I was confronted with this reality of knowing about the history of apartheid in South Africa and knowing that the wine industry there was a $3.5 billion industry wherein there was only two Black families who owned any of the land, even though Black and Indigenous workers made up over 95% of the workforce. So it really, at that point I decided to use wine as a way of telling broader stories, telling more complete stories, sort of decolonizing wine. And the way that we did that, as you can hear me now trying to unpack it all, there was a lot to explain because these weren't really narratives that were at all relevant or prevalent in the wine industry at that time. So there was a lot of education that had to happen, education about South Africa's political and social upheaval, history about, you know, colonization in South Africa, tying it to colonization here in the United States of America, and kind of aligning our struggle with the struggle of, the laborers and not just the laborers, but really the people of the Western Cape of South Africa who had, you know, for centuries been part of this vibrant industry, who centuries later had no ownership in it. So I worked with a filmmaker to kind of tell this story. And I know the nonprofit lasted for just over 3 years. We were 501c3, so we succumbed to the 2008 crisis. I went back and I moved to California, got back in the restaurant industry, started managing at a very reputable restaurant in San Francisco called Nopa, where I had a very cool job for a few years in which I basically was running like a education program, both a public and internal educational program, where I would take our staff to field trips, and also did some public education around field trips, really tapped in deeply to the California farm to table culture, and wanted to chronicle that story a little more deeply than the superficial way that it was being understood, which is just like name checking some farms on the bottom of a menu. And I really became homies and deeply, you know, immersed in that world of California agrarians, multi-generational families, young farmers. And, you know, as I'd already been like politicized with my work in food, the vision for Whetstone really came from thinking back on my experience with the nonprofit and also the relationships and the stories and the knowledge that I was gaining from spending so much time on the land with the farmers. And so I had seeded the idea for you know, a couple years, and then finally was able to come to market in 2017.
Could you talk a little bit more about that, the source of the idea for Whetstone, and what you felt like was missing in food media at the time, or I guess probably still today?
You also started to touch on this tension you were describing with who's getting the credit and who is actually doing the work. And obviously you're using wine as an example, which is perfect. Can you also touch on that tension?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think actually it's the same question. Your question and the answer to both are actually completely related. What was missing at the time was really what we're just finally starting to see in food media is a proper reckoning and a proper accounting of credit and a more complete and honest narrative about the recipes that people profit off of, whether it be through their own restaurants or increasingly through brands and media affiliations and platforms. So what I was observing is, especially having worked in restaurants, were white chefs who went to the CIA, who did stages at NoMa, who did stages at, you know, top 100 restaurants, and then they were able to parlay that into, you know, their chef de cuisine positions, and then they would be bankrolled for some ridiculous sum of money for their new restaurant. They would have the PR lined up. They would have, you know, all the right journalists and the right food writers on deck, and then their restaurant was just deemed to be the next new thing. We all accept it at face value, and then you rinse and repeat with the next restaurant opening, which is really why you saw such a proliferation of homogenous restaurants across the country, really starting, like, I would say in the year 2000 going up until this very moment. So with this contraction, even though it's unfortunate, I think there will be kind of a correction for some of the redundancy that we saw, which was perpetuated by the food media. And that was really upsetting for me, because especially even working in the kinds of restaurants with the kinds of food that, you know, were very familiar, presented through this European lens, at the end of the day, the chefs who were getting the credit were basically working, like, you know, 9 to 5 type hours, kicking it with their families, going to the farmer's market, maybe, you know, maybe cooking for a couple hours on the line one day, and then they were going back home. And you know, they certainly, as owners of the business, had created that infrastructure. But to only talk about the chef and not the sous chef, who was probably from somewhere in Central America, or the really talented prep cook who was, like, you know, crushing an insane amount of vegetables in an insanely short amount of time that enables you to do the volumes that you do, like, the omission from those people and those stories, not to mention the ghastly omission of agriculture, of the farmers, of the politics. Like, honestly, where did the shit come from? You know, like this is the most fundamental question. And right. And it was completely absent from the way that we talked about food.
That's also reflective of how we think about food. Because I think we're still at a point where so often when food is consumed, it's consumed in this mindless manner that doesn't acknowledge what it took for the food to come into existence. And when you're faced with something like the COVID crisis that we're facing right now, where it's like, hey, there are people that work, you know, in essentially factories where the food is being butchered and processed and all of this kind of stuff. It's almost this, like, complete just erasing of the fact that, like you mentioned, there's this whole process before food ends up on our grocery shelves. And it takes it to be missing for us to think about it, or for it to become mainstream news. Like, hey, we have this whole system, and if there's any issue with any part of the system, it's going to be felt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, the word that you just used, erasure, is so, so important. And I think it's exactly the correct word. And I think the stakes of erasure are really high. You know, a lot of our work and the way that I think about my work is really a response to erasure and the harm that it perpetuates. And, you know, I think in food media, the ways in which that has been happening and still happens, but again, we're policing it now, which is good. But basically it would be like, you know, chefs or cooks going to other places, taking ideas that have been cultivated by people who have no agency or opportunity to profit from it in the way that these aforementioned chefs who came through these very, very well manicured and maintained pipelines. And what happens is not only the injustice of not being able to share, you know, in the profits, but it is a complete erasure of the cultures and the cultural knowledge and the ancestral knowledge built over centuries and centuries and in cases millennia. And it brings it all through this very diluted, singular, monochromatic European filter, and erasing people's identities, erasing people's histories, when people are still here and participating in society, mm-hmm. is very, very damaging. So I think that's a really, really critical word. And we try to use our space in food media to make present what historically the media has excluded or erased.
I didn't want to talk about her, but can we talk about Alison Roman? Because yes, what you please. Just said, I think kind of hits on the issue that a lot of people have felt about her recipe writing and failure of acknowledgement in particular. And for those of our listeners who haven't been following, she's a columnist for the New York Times. She writes recipes. She's a cookbook author. Very successful.
Not so much a columnist for the New York Times anymore, maybe, but she was.
She's very popular, very successful. And one of her fairly recent viral recipes, she called the stew, but it was essentially a curry. And this is something that people have noted with her recipes over time is, as Stephen was pointing, right, there's this whole generational ancestral knowledge that is built and accumulated upon, and something like making a curry and that specific combination of ingredients is one of those things. So when someone essentially makes a curry but doesn't call it a curry at a time where this isn't even something of the past. This is something of the present. Like, what kind of harm is that doing? How is that promoting white supremacy? And how are we all continuously playing into white supremacy through food and through recipes? And Stephen, I have a question. Did you ever try the traditional food media route? Because you're obviously someone with a keen eye. The aesthetics of Whetstone Magazine is beautiful, and your editorial skills. Did you attempt to go that traditional food media route, and did you face obstacles, or did you just know from your experience in the industry as a sommelier that you wanted to just kind of build something anew?
Yeah, both actually. So I'm going to try to answer briefly with this Alison Roman situation, but not even making it about her as so much her just very obvious public gaffes have afforded us like great fodder to learn from and to grow from and to comment on. So that's the spirit in which I'm commenting on this from. You know, it's very uncomfortable for still many white people in the United States to even hear the word or language white supremacy. It stresses them out. And I think that fundamentally, like, that is something that needs to be said and
confronted honestly and repeatedly, because it is a pervasive and extremely lethally harmful system. And so a failure to acknowledge it, or a failure to speak on it because it causes discomfort, actually has consequences that are lethal for other American citizens. So that's just, first of all, we have to talk about the discomfort just so we can talk about it. And the way that that shows up in food is really nuanced, right? Because, and that's why it took us a long time to really kind of change the tide of the conversation, because white people and what white supremacy allows and is for people like Alice and Roman to absolve themselves of any racial or ethnic identity, right? And by absolving themselves of any racial or ethnic identity, it kind of de-escalates all of the harm that colonization has caused for non-white people, right? Because it allows them to have their identities stand kind of unscathed and pure and malleable to suit them and to suit their narrative, where oppressed communities do not have the same luxury. And not to mention oppressed communities, indigenous Americans, African Americans who were brought over and enslaved. We are the ones, and I'm just talking about in this country, of course, the stew is even pulling from a South Asian tradition. But what happens is, when it comes through this aforementioned filter, the erasure doesn't just cause, emotional and psychological pain. It erases our entire history. The food is our language. It is how we communicate with each other. It's how we teach each other. It's how it's part of our constitution. It's part of our healthcare. And so the erasure really undermines, that legacy for people of color. And it's part of a continued legacy of erasure, which has been so harmful for us. So, I think that absolution of a racial background, I really want to push back against that, because it really kind of feeds into this narrative of white people who benefit from white supremacy as innocent, right? As just bystanders, because they have this racially ambiguous background. And then, to the other questions around that, in food or from a culinary perspective, what does it look like for someone who is a columnist in the New York Times, and not like a chef? It's not like, their ways in which they're profiting off of this are not exactly congruent. All she had to do was just give credit. It's so simple. That's all people are asking for. And actually, as a journalist, as a food writer, it really undermines her work. And this is why we try to center all of our work on origin, because our kind of central thesis is that it's not really possible to understand food without understanding it as part of an anthropological conversation between humans and plants and migration, and the migration of people and plant matter and information. And so by her just diminishing it, she's diminishing her own work by taking this rich history and just dumbing it down to something called the stew.
I think the ways that this happens, I'm talking about appropriation right now, with chefs versus food writers, is slightly different. And so for this particular situation, if for listeners, it is unclear what the desired course of action would have been, it simply would have been to properly attribute the historical origins of the ingredients that were being used in the dish. And, for me as like you know, it really kind of underscored why I wanted to start Whetstone, and the annoyance that I had with publications like Bon Appetit, where, you know, she worked at prior to her, and I think even maybe still works with, is just like they, I mean, I am singling them out actually, only, but because they're the largest. And so, you know, they have the largest burden to bear, and they've caused the most harm because, you know, they have the largest platform. And so essentially what, you know, what I was frustrated by in starting Whetstone is that even as a reader, as someone who loves food, the food writing is diminished immensely by you withholding the origins of the dish and the context of the cuisine. Mm. Because not only are you erasing an entire culture, and the thing about the erasure too, like it's so deep, like because the trauma of the erasure is you're talking about people who are in a white supremacist society who have whether they were born into this country like I was, or whether they've arrived, we're all operating through the same lens, filter, and framework of whiteness. It's like the air we breathe. It's everywhere. It's everywhere to the degree that we don't even think about it. We just, the next breath just comes. But for people who aren't white, it's like our breaths are harder to come by. Yeah. And that's really, really hard for white people to understand. And so things that seem like, you know, what is the big deal? Is this just like another microaggression that's being blown out of proportion? When you're fighting for the survival of your ancestry, of your likeness and your identity, when your likeness and identity has been such a threat to the country that they've essentially waged war against your likeness and identity, these injustices matter tremendously. And so I'm really glad that we're at a point in the culture where, you know, we are holding people more accountable. And I hope that both Allison and her many followers use it as an opportunity. Like, I don't, like I've said before, like, I don't want to see her get canceled. I want to see her keep the same wave and all the same fans, and that very lengthy apology letter that she wrote talking about what she learned and how she's gone to. I want to see it. Mm. And if she does it, then I think it'll be, to my mind, the first time, or at least to my eyes, I should say, I'm not familiar, but it'll be the first time where we really see a white woman with a large platform truly be held accountable, hold themselves accountable, and do the real work of political education, of racial education that white people have to do to properly be allies. And so I hope she keeps her platform, and I hope she keeps the same energy that she had in that apology letter. And if she does, then we'll be better off because of it.
I just have one more question about this, and then we can move on to more important things. But how do you think the blowback against her would have been different if she had attacked a black woman instead of an Asian woman, or two Asian women?
Interesting question. I think that... that's a very interesting question, Ethan. I mean,
we have kept that same energy. We as in the vocal.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. That's the first thing that comes to my mind. I'm like thinking that black women are the ones who are really out here on the front lines, you know, riding hard for all black indigenous POCs. Right. Because
black men also, we ride hard. Black men.
And of course, writing hard for black men, of course. And so honestly, like, I would say that probably the first real, like, vocal majority of people that I saw, like, calling bullshit on that interview were black women. And because it was very consistent with the same stuff that black women have been calling out in the industry for a long time, you know, because black women are essentially the least visible and the least advocated for in our society. And so when you're invisible to society, it actually has a reverse effect of making you incredible at observing. And so Black women are the most keen observers in our society, and they're also the most keen observers of injustice in our society because they can recognize it. And so, you know, would society have cared less if Alison Roman had talked shit about a Black woman instead of an Asian woman? What I know about our society tells me that, yeah, we would have cared less. But on the other hand, what I know about Black women is that we would have been ringing the alarm on her so fast, and the same way this lady in Central Park just lost her job in 24 hours, the same way, you know, it's just like those are Black women who recognize this shit. And, you know, I know it makes people uncomfortable, but people using the internet to raise awareness when there was never any justice or equality to begin with, like, you know, I think people are doing what they need to do in the name of justice. And you see what happened, because the truth of the matter is we would not have gotten that very articulate apology from Alison Roman if she could have got away with it. She could have done all that harm. She was out here reposting it after it came out. Right. So she could have done all that harm. We could have just laughed it off how we did in the old days. Yeah. And the harm would have been perpetuated and it would have been normalized. And so now we're at a point where we're like, OK, that's no longer OK. And instead of, you know, being sympathetic to her cause or her loss of platform or any of that stuff, I'm like, no, she did harm. She now has to do the work of her own political education. And she's not even going to lose her platform. That's the thing.
Right.
She ain't going to lose her platform.
Because the New York Times.
She'll be okay. And now it's incumbent on.
And the New York.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
They came out and said that they did not fire her. They were like, oh, her.
No, they put her time out. She'll be all right.
Yeah. There were reports that she had been fired, but they clarified. They were very vocal in clarifying that those reports were not accurate. So yeah,
she'll be all right.
I mean, wow. All right. So Ethan, you want to take us to break?
On that note, let's take a quick break and we'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee. A cherry isn't just a cherry. When it comes to tart cherries, the wonderfully U.S.-grown Montmorency tart cherry variety is the cherry with more. They're available year-round, dried, frozen, canned, juice, and concentrate. U.S. Montmorency tart cherries are also one of America's superfruit, which means they're good for you. Tart cherries contain many antioxidants and beneficial phytonutrients, including anthocyanins, the pigments that give tart cherries their bright red color. And don't forget about flavor. U.S. Montmorency's unique sour-sweet profile make them an excellent addition to yogurt, oatmeal, salads, trail mix, and of course, a classic cherry pie. Learn more about the wonderfully U.S.-grown Montmorency tart cherry at choosecherries.com.
And we're back. We're joined this week by Stephen Satterfield, co-founder of Whetstone Magazine, host of the Point of Origin podcast on iHeartRadio, and sommelier, restaurant veteran, food origin expert all around.
Food activist.
The conversation wound up focusing a little more on Alison Roman than I imagined it would. But I think we got, there were some really interesting points around that. So I don't know. I'm interested in hearing about how that connects to your work at Whetstone. How do you, given the context of white supremacy that you talked about, that we all know that we're living and working and writing and eating in, how do you create a piece of media, whether it's an article or an entire publication, as you've done, that truly rejects that, or that presents an alternative approach to understanding our food?
Right. Mm-hmm. And I want to say your publication speaks to everyone. Yes, you are a Black man who founded and is the editor of this, but this is not a quote unquote black publication with just quote unquote black articles, which traditional media often wants to pigeonhole minorities into. So, yeah.
Yeah. thank you for pointing that out. You know, the advantage that we have is that our communities actually reflect the global communities and global diasporas. And so what's really hard for white institutions is to genuinely be in relationship to people who are not of the same class and privilege. And so you see that repeatedly with editors and the kinds of people who get hired to work in newsrooms and at newspapers. You know, again, this is all like, I'm trying really not hard to not speak in absolutes here because things are different. Like, you know, the fact that we have Soleil Ho at the San Francisco Chronicle, like we have just a plethora of amazing South Asian women in the food game who kill it, Taylor and Kush, like I'm just talking about like kind of overarching observations here. I just want to say that. But you know, what we are able to do is basically create a publication and a brand that looks like the rest of the world, because that's what our friends look like, you know, that's what our neighbors look like. You know, my business partner is an Asian American woman, and like, you know, between her diaspora and her family and her lived experiences and, you know, my background, I grew up, you know, in it just outside of Atlanta, going to a school called Clarkston, or in a suburb of Atlanta called Clarkston, Georgia, where many refugee communities settled there in the 80s and 90s. I think still it's probably outside of like maybe where you are right now, Ethan, maybe Queens, like one of the most diverse places in the country. So, you know, my formative memories of like childhood friends are like Ethiopian girl, a Russian dude, a Cambodian dude. Like, that's how I was raised. And so, you know, it's really hard for white people who haven't been in relationship to POCs in their lives to, relate to them. And so when they try to, you know, report or share our stories, or I guess non-white stories, sometimes it feels a little forced because it has to come through a particular editorial lens. Of comfort or digestibility. Whereas when we have people from other communities, you know, that we work with or center on, we focus a lot on indigenous communities, especially in the Americas. We've never written a story about indigenous communities in America. Like, we've let them write those stories, and it's our job to figure out a business model for the ink and the paper so that they can tell those stories, you know, uninterrupted. We do work with journalists, you know, from other parts of the world who, you know, are not always of the ethnic or racial background that we're covering, but those are exceptions, and those journalists really have shown themselves to be incredible stewards and keepers of the cultural knowledge that they've ascertained. And we, even in those stories, it's all very, very, very heavily influenced with firsthand stories. And we use indigenous photographers to whatever region that we're in. So honestly, the same standards that we're calling for, like if you're doing a story about black chefs, like, why not have a black photographer? You know, why not, you know, like, ask yourself about the utility of the story or the potential diminished potency of the story when you have, in my case, like a black story with an editor that doesn't have the cultural literacy or cultural background to handle those stories with care. And that's one of the things that I'm the most proud of with Whetstone, is that, you know, the different global communities that we've covered have all felt like their stories have been handled with care.
And that's exactly what we're trying to do, because it's so hard. I mean, we've had so many people pitch us with stories around ancestral knowledge or experiences or recipes that they said, like, there was nowhere else where we really could have seen this story fitting other than Whetstone. And that is like, those are the types of interactions that really keep me motivated to keep growing our work and our platform.
We've only got a couple of minutes left. Should we do a little rapid fire, Valerie?
Sure. Or you want to talk
about anything else first?
Okay, let's lighten things up a little.
We could keep it heavy if you want. You want to talk about
anything? I would love to keep it heavy, but only because, Stephen, you are a sommelier. I wanted to get your quick take on this really popular Netflix movie that came out recently about this young Black man and his attempts to pass the sommelier exam. Have you seen it? It's called Uncorked.
I have seen it.
What are your thoughts on this movie?
Well, my main thought is that I was very disappointed that I was not cast for the lead. I felt that was a major oversight by Netflix and their team. No, it was great. It was really... I can't remember all the character's name, but what I really enjoyed about it is that the acting was actually really the mom and the dad.
Oh yeah, Be Nash.
Yes, their rapport.
Awesome. Yeah.
It was just like, I think every Black person, every African American person who has like family in the South or who understands like cookout culture and African-American communities, like there's something about their rapport and some of the scenery around that, which I felt was really spot on and heartwarming in a way. And then as far as like the actual testing and all that, it was very accurate, you know, the way that they laid out the glassware, the kinds of tests, the tasting groups, and how you talk about homogeneity, like these guys are not capable really of not even talking about something else, but thinking about other stuff too. Like it's really all wine all the time. It's competitive like that. So I thought actually on the whole, it was a good movie. I was prepared for it to be like a little more cheesy
than
it was. Yeah, I think that's what I thought about it.
Okay, Stephen gives it one thumb up at least, maybe two. Not a quick fire question, but Ethan.
No, I liked it.
I haven't seen it.
I don't have need quick to watch fire it. Answers. That's the issue. Yeah, you should check it out.
All right, let's do some quick questions, and then we'll wrap up the interview. Let's start with. Maybe this is not a quick answer, but do you have a favorite wine or an interesting wine that you've had recently that something that surprised you?
Favorite wine is an impossible question.
Yeah.
I have, I'm a moody drinker and a seasonal drinker. So, you know, I love bubbles and effervescent stuff. So, I love champagne. And when I can't afford that, then a very dry cava is a great substitute. And then like wine regions of the world, like many sommeliers, I think the best value and kind of daily drinking wines are Gamays from the Beaujolais region and Burgundy. I love the crews of Julinas and Flory in particular. Other than that, you know, I'm kind of equal opportunity drinker. I just like the very best example of whatever I'm drinking or craving.
Are there, since you did this work with Black and Indigenous winemakers in South Africa, are there wines available to purchase in the US?
Yeah, there's many, South African wines. And in fact, the families that we were working with, back then they are still kicking it. They're still doing their thing, which is amazing. One of the families is called Mahudi, M H-U-D-I. They have a grape that they make called Pinotage, which is one of the grapes that's indigenous to South Africa. And then they do these really great Bordeaux style blends, which is to say Cabernet Merlot blends. And then my homegirl Nitsiki Biela, she was the first Black woman in South Africa to be a winemaker. She's killing it right now. She has a label with an import company called Wine for the World. So if you go to wine4theworld.com, I think you can find her wines on there, which have won all kinds of awards. So yeah, I mean, it's really cool. Like a lot of the, and with Nitsiki, you know, she was one of the people that inspired me to go forth with that mission. And I have even some film, I mean, talking about media and how I got into it. You know, I have footage of Nitsiki in 2007 or 8 talking about how one day she wanted to captain her own ship, you know, and today that's exactly what she's doing and she's thriving. And I feel like in a sense, we've kind of grown up in our careers together, and I'm just so proud of her. Wow, I'm really bad at rapid fire. Sorry, guys. But yeah, Nitsiki Biela. Yeah, I can send y'all info. I don't know if you like to whatever show notes or something, but
yeah.
If people are interested in where to get Black and indigenous South African wines, and I can make that happen.
Yeah. Okay. Do we have time for one more question? Because I want to talk about, Stephen, I just want your take on our wine drinking habits over the past few months with quarantine. Like, what's your take on this? Is the world about to run out of wine? Did I read that somewhere?
No way. We're not going to run out of wine. But it's, well, the drinking habit. So people are drinking more than usual. I think it's not hard to understand why. The issue with wine is going to be the same issue that we have with agriculture on a much larger scale, which is who's going to harvest the fruit, right? That's not really our strong suit here as folks born in the U.S., but we love consuming all that stuff. So there is going to be some kind of a reckoning around that. But honestly, most winemakers of the kinds certainly that we're talking about right now have enough inventory, because cellaring and aging wine is inherently part of the sport. So, I mean, you know, there is inventory, and there's plenty of consumers who are able to order wine online right now. So it's kind of like what Ethan and I were just talking about, kind of a course correction of the supply chain. It doesn't necessarily, the demand doesn't disappear, it just gets moved around a bit. And in that movement, can be some interruptions or irregularities with the supply, but we're not going to run out of wine.
Great. All right. Do not hoard wine, people. I think that's what Stephen is trying to tell us. There's no need to hoard wine.
I'm saying drink it. It's okay. And if you have a really nice bottle that you've been saving for a special occasion, a pandemic is a pretty special occasion. So you should drink it without guilt, too.
That is a very great point. On that note, Stephen, can you let our listeners know where they can find you and where they can find your work?
Yes. Thanks for letting me plug. You can find me at whetstonemagazine.com, where we sell our print magazines, where you can also find our podcast on there, which is the Point of Origin podcast. A podcast about food origins and anthropology that we make with iHeartRadio. And if you want to follow me on social media, you can do that too. My handle is at @ISawStephen with a PH, and that's my handle for every social media thing. And that's it.
Great. Thanks to Jess, our long-suffering sound engineer. Thanks to the Red Crickets for our theme song, which is called Blind. As always, you can reach us at whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org or on social media at whyfoodpodcast. You can reach me via my spice company, Burlap and Barrel, at Burlap and Barrel on Instagram.
And you can reach me on social at Foodie in New York.
And most of all, thank you to our guest this week, Stephen Satterfield. This was a fascinating conversation, and I hope we can bring you back sometime soon. I'd like to continue it. Thanks for joining us.
Yes. Thank you, Ethan. Thank you, Valerie. It was a pleasure to talk to you both.
Thanks. Same. All right. We'll see you guys next week.
Why Food is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.